Leslie, it is I who thank you. Thank you for leadership of this organization that has been the right and a remarkably good home for the project that you referred to, and especially for tonight, you and your colleagues in organizing it, because I see so many faces in the audience of old and wonderful friends. So I'm looking forward to the evening. We're going to talk, Tom and I, about the U.S.-Russia relationship at this state, 1 year into the Obama administration. And I start by saying that the relationship today, in my view, is at a very different place from where it was a year ago, January 2009. The residual traces of what had been a seriously deteriorated relationship accumulated over the 5 or 6 years before January 2009 are still there, and they are certainly capable of reviving, of re-emerging. When we started the project that Leslie referred to in April of 2008, we had been through a six-year period from late 2002, rocky and steadily deteriorating, but still 6 months before what was freefall in the relationship in the context of the Russian-Georgian War in August 2008. That was a war that many in Moscow, including senior people in the leadership, thought of as the first proxy war against the United States in the post-Cold War period. And we know now that leadership in both countries contemplated the possibility that that war could have escalated beyond the bounds that we knew it in the fall of August and September. For a number of us at that time, some in government, but a number of people on the outside, this was not only, especially those in the Russia field, this was not only a regrettable in a dangerous state of circumstances, it was also, in some important respects, an unnatural and even illogical circumstance, given where we thought things were going at the end of the Cold War in 1991 and 1992. Unnatural and even illogical because there was no deep, ideologically driven animus that was sustaining or supporting enmity between the two countries. There was no vast gap in the core international security issues that both countries faced at that point, at least not in theory. And there was no comparability in power between the two countries that would sustain or support a wide-ranging strategic rivalry. And yet there we were in January 2009, after everything that had happened, especially in 2008. As I said at the outset, I think we are at a different place at this point. It is ambiguous in many respects. It is uncertain in other respects, but it's a different position. And I think it's for two basic reasons. The first is the impact of the financial economic crisis, and the second is the election of Barack Obama. And I believe it's the second, that is the new directions in U.S. foreign policy, particularly toward Russia, that is key between the two. It was for those of us involved in the project, and I think a lot of other people who follow the U.S.-Russia relationship in the United States and in Europe, clear that if the trend line from fall 2002 through 2008 was going to be broken, if that inertia was to be transformed, it would have to be because of U.S. leadership. It wasn't going to occur on the Russian side. There was too much skepticism, there was too much paralysis, there was too great an unwillingness to even try, let alone to try or even to think about what would be necessary in order to change things. So it did require the initiative on the part of the Obama administration. The question then is why the Obama administration did it, given the other problems that it faced in foreign policy coming into office. My own view is that there are two reasons why the change has occurred in the Obama administration. The first may be subconscious. I don't know that it was consciously articulated by the president or his team before or after the election. That subconscious consideration is that if you think about U.S. relations with major powers, the relationship that was in greatest disrepair among U.S. relations with major powers was with Russia. And if the administration was going to begin turning things around in terms of the dynamics that were worked between the U.S. and great powers in all respects, that is, the deterioration in those dynamics, particularly after 2003, Russia would be the hard case and a good problem to make progress on. But the core reason, which was quite conscious and which was articulated, was managing a nuclear world. And for those of you that followed the president's positions, that is, presidential candidate's position during the election, he was quite clear that the single most important issue that he would face as president was managing a nuclear world. He did not articulate a Russia policy during the campaign. They were working on it within the working group, but it was never articulated in any comprehensive fashion. But each time he talked about the need to address the nuclear question, both nuclear proliferation and managing weapons among those that had them, it was underscored the importance of Russia in making progress on that was underscored. What did Obama do then, the Obama administration, from the beginning in January? I think several things. The first was he made Russia a priority. He made Russia a priority in a way that surprised, I think, virtually everyone, including those on his Russia team. I know from direct contact with him at the time. He gave as much time to Russia in those first months as he did to the problem of the problems of Iraq or Afghanistan. And of the strategic reviews that were first prepared by the administration, the first three were Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Russia. The second thing they did was to stress, because they embraced the notion of the importance of Russia in U.S. foreign policy, something that no prior administration had done in order to underscore the stakes that we have in that relationship. And that has been one of the key weaknesses of U.S. policy since 1991, a failure to articulate, because I think a failure to face on the part of national leadership, how ramified and substantial the stakes are in the U.S. relationship with Russia. In April, when William Burns, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, spoke in Washington, he said there is no country in the world that has a capacity to affect the outcome of U.S. foreign policy, that is, the success of U.S. foreign policy in more areas than Russia. He didn't say that makes Russia the most important other country. That's a very important distinction. But he did say there's no country that touches on more issues of concern to the U.S. than Russia. Third, they started, as a practical matter, by changing the tone of the relationship. That's what the Biden speech a year ago next week at the Munich Security Conference was all about, the famous metaphor, the reset, things that have followed. Secondly, they decided to focus on a number of core problems, and those core problems have been at the very center of the foreign policy since. The first was quickly moving on a follow-on agreement for START 1 that expired in December of this past year, Afghanistan, Iran, the nuclear issue around Iran, and then nuclear nonproliferation. But those issues were then set within an extensive agenda, and that extensive agenda was already outlined and negotiated with the Russians by April 2009 at the end of the G20 meeting in London. If you go back and look at that joint statement, it is a very ambitious agenda that Medvedev and Obama signed on to. Not just START, nonproliferation, nuclear terrorism, but everything from European security architecture to progress on the Middle East, transnational security threats such as drug trafficking, organized crime, corruption, from stabilizing South Asia, meaning including the Afghan problem, to increasing economic ties. By July, at the summit, genuine progress had been made on a number of these issues, enough so that if that was the test for being able to move forward, the administration was satisfied that the basis was there. And indeed, the outline on the first major issue, that is, a follow-on for START 1, the outline of what that agreement would look like, the thrust of that agreement, was in place. The devil, since then, has been in the details, and we continue to be delayed in concluding the agreement. But the understanding of what that agreement's going to look like had been achieved by July. They also established a binational presidential commission. I may be mistaken, but I think this is the only presidential commission that exists in U.S. foreign policy with major powers at this point. It is a presidential commission chaired by the foreign ministers, our Secretary of State and their foreign minister. It has 16 working groups and then subcommittees as well that include everything from counterterrorism to business development to energy, to nuclear energy and nuclear security, but also health, handling emergency situations, civil society. In fact, a civil society working group that is led by one of the hardliners on the Russian side, Vyacheslav Surkov, and by Michael McFaul, who is the president's special advisor, director on Russia, Eurasia, in the White House. There was a final element at the level of concept on the part of the administration that has not been noticed and not much featured in the press or even within the expert community. And that is the notion that from this point forward, the administration would engage Russia on a multi-level basis, a multi-level engagement of Russia, not just government to government, but the civil society part is an important portion of it, as well as the business community. And the notion that until we began engaging the two business communities and creating stakeholders in the relationship, it would be very difficult to create a foundation that had some durability, some stability during moments of difficulty. That's the reason why, though they didn't call it this, in July, there were actually three summits. There was the government-to-government summit. There was then the business summit with more than 200 representatives from the U.S. side. And then there was also a civil society summit and an effort to since then to follow up on that. So then what's happened? I have two further points on this score. What's happened and what are the shadows and potential pitfalls? In terms of what's happened, my view is that there has been genuine but very slow progress. This is an impacted process, a difficult process, and in many respects, a disappointing process to both sides. But it has been facilitated by several things. The first is the effects of the economic crisis, which has been bracing for the Soviet leadership and for the Russian leadership. And as a result, the watchwords now, the discourse in Moscow is for patience and sacrifice, no longer the boasting about becoming the country's, the world's fifth most productive economy and into one of the world's new financial centers, but much greater modesty and then also reserve when it comes to the way in which they're behaving externally, including the way in which they've now re-engaged with Europeans that they had dismissed, EU and otherwise, earlier. Secondly, the administration's decision on ballistic missile defense. This was not done in order to please the Russians or grease the tracks of the relationship. It had its own basis, its own reasons, but the effect was to facilitate the chain. And the third was, again, the objective circumstance that the Ukraine and Georgian question of NATO membership was simply taken off the table by events, by everything that had been happening in the last year or so, including attitudes of Europeans on the issue, the Germans, the Italians, the French, and so on. The focus throughout this period has been on the immediate issues that I outlined earlier. That is the follow-on agreement for START 1, Iran, Afghanistan, and non-proliferation. In my view, the START 1 agreement, as I understand it, is almost done. Jones and Mullen were both in Moscow last week. They are satisfied that they made progress on a couple of the remaining very difficult issues. There's an issue around telemetry, which I think they now, for those in the audience that are aware of what the issue is, that they have worked their way through it. The issue of the link between missile defense, active defense, and this interim agreement, delaying the first issue, ballistic missile defense, to follow-on discussion, I think that's been worked out. And the problem is the very technical set of issues around verifications. On Afghanistan, the issue has been the transit route, both for lethal and non-lethal, the air and the ground route. And while the press has reported this as being essentially a failure because the Russians have blocked it, not much has happened. It is true there have been complications around it, but it's in place, it's working, and they are satisfied that this agreement is is going to be important and productive in the near term. On Iran, William Burns in Moscow midweek, 2 weeks ago, in January, said in his characterization that the U.S.-Iranian relationship or the U.S.-Russia relationship on Iran was working well. He cited in particular the degree to which the U.S. and the Russians had been key in developing the IAEA program offered to Iran for the export of the low enriched uranium in return for the supply of fuel rods down the road. That has not been successful at this point. The issue then is sanctions and where the Russians will be. The Russians blow hot and cold on sanctions, but they have, since the fall, with Medvedev's visit to the U.S., put themselves on record as saying that in circumstances where there appears to be no alternative, that they would support sanctions. We'll see. The administration is getting ready to present a set of sanctions within the Security Council. And therefore, in three of the four areas, there has been slow, as I said, impacted, but real progress. The fourth issue we will be seeing in the spring, that is the issue of nuclear nonproliferation. The nuclear security conference that will be held in April under the president's auspices. The White House reports that the Russians have been cooperative in that area, have been supportive. And then, of course, the review conference for NPT in May. We'll see what the two sides are able to do in that area. The presidential commission architecture has been very slow to get moving, but the administration, as I understand it, and speaking with people within it, have not used this as the primary measuring stick for judging whether the process is working. They focus primarily on the four issues that I've discussed. That's where the tests are being set for whether this thing can be pushed forward. Nonetheless, this machinery is important, and it's, as I say, been very slow to operate. The working group, for example, on business development in Russia, which is the critical link between the business community and that multi-level approach that I'm talking about, and creating the basis that the administration is eager to have in place, had its first meeting this week. And it's under the chair of Gary Locke, the Secretary of Commerce, and then Elvira Nabulina, the counterpart on the Russian side. They met down the road at MIT. There was also at that time a major conference this week, it's just concluding, led by Igor Shuvalov on the Russian side, the deputy prime minister, and a set of counterparts on the U.S. side, exploring the U.S. experience in how universities and entrepreneurs and companies and financiers collaborate in order to get technology from the laboratory to the market, an area particularly in high tech, nanotechnology in particular, that the Russians are especially interested in. The other piece of this, in order for those of you that know the history of the way these things have worked in the past in prior administrations, back to the Clinton administration and then in the Bush administration as well, when you have something like the Presidential Commission or where you're looking for something like strategic dialogue, if you will, across a range of issues, is authority that is imbued with power by those at the very top, and hence the importance of the Clinton-Lavrov connection, but then also has teeth and can pull these various bureaucracies together that are in the 16 working groups. That level, that critical level, is at the undersecretary level with Bill Burns, who is splendid in this role, and his counterpart, a very able man named Sergei Ryabkov on the Russian side, and they have just met in order to try to push this thing forward, but it's been slow going. The more serious obstacle, in my view, on the U.S. side has been the failure to deliver on a number of things that the administration had said would be high priorities and would be done early in the administration. They include things like the repeal of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, moving forward rapidly on the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, moving forward on the 1-2-3 Civil Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, none of which has occurred, nor is it going to occur quickly. On the Russian side, things have been complicated by the vacillation over whether the Russians really are serious about WTO, the linkage now to this idea of a customs union that Putin raised in June of this year, their uncompromising attitude following the suspension of participation in the Conventional Forces Treaty in Europe, and as a result, their refusal to be part of the data exchange or the monitoring arrangements that are set up under that agreement and a series of other things. So finally, where are the shadows and potential pitfalls in what I've talked about? I think first and most imminent will be the familiar story of politics in both countries. The attitude among a variety of people, particularly within the Congress, remains skeptical. There are priorities that will get in the way even when that START-1 agreement is brought before the Senate for action. It'll get caught up in the way people are reacting to the nuclear posture review and the issues of nuclear modernization, including the issue of reliable replacement warhead. All of those things are going to be a complication for how well the ratification process goes in START-1. Even the decision to proceed with CTBT or with 1-2-3 is going to get caught up in this complicated process and people who will have alternative agendas. We've seen a variety of critiques of where the administration is going, at least implicitly, in the way in which key senators and congresspeople have responded to a series of things, everything from the tentative prospective French decision to sell the Mistral helicopter carrier to the Russians, to even the moderate Senator Richard Lugar's proposal in a recent report on beginning to provide defense equipment that would be the kind of equipping necessary to Georgia that would be necessary in order to strengthen their capacity to cope in another conflict with Russia. In short, the sentiment about neo-containment, that kind of a strategy in the U.S. is far from receding. On the contrary, in some quarters, the idea of neo-containment with all of the implications about the way in which you judge the Russia challenge and deal with it is still very much alive. On the Russia side, there is strong resistance and mistrust in the security circles, including parts of the military. And there has been either an inability or an unwillingness on the part of Russia's national leadership to crack bureaucratic heads. It's one of the reasons why the process has been so impacted. Secondly, the immediate issues in the relationship that I've been talking about, follow on to START-1, Afghanistan, Iran, non-proliferation, are not embedded in a larger strategic vision. Strategic thinking that will provide guidance and a basis for, if you will, a strategic concept for dealing with Russia. I don't expect that on the Russian side. I don't think they're in the shape to do it, but it will. It is important for the U.S. at some point, if they really do mean to put the relationship on a different footing, to do it. They haven't done it up to this point, and given the pressures and the normal rhythms of Washington, that prospect is diminishing, not increasing. It should have been done at the very beginning when they had a chance to do it and didn't. Third, there are deep underlying sources of tension that remain unattended in the relationship, the underlying problem. And at the very core of that is the interaction between the United States and Russia within the post-Soviet space. It is the great unaddressed elephant in the room or problem in the relationship, and until the U.S. and Russia directly and frankly begin working out a modus vivendi for how that interaction is going to take place, the relationship is going to be continually penalized and impeded in all of its other aspects. This turn, in turn, is linked with what doesn't and doesn't happen as we now reopen the question of improving on European security architecture more broadly. And there are other issues, but that's the central one. So let me finish. The fourth, I think, is what I would call Russia's strategic ambivalence, uncertainty about where it is in the outside world. And that uncertainty has not diminished, that's increased from my point of view. On one day, the Russians recognize, in the case of their relationship with Europe, the importance of Europe, their economic stake in the relationship with Europe. The next day, they're talking about Europe's diminished importance in international politics, the possibility, even the need to dismiss Russia, to dismiss Europe and the EU and move on to other things. Simultaneously, they wrestle with the question of how they think about their relationship with the rising new powers, and particularly in the context of BRIC, of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And then there is a new subcategory within what I've just referred to as Russia and BRIC. It is the Russia-China relationship. Here, for me, the new dimension is not the issue of strategic choice or strategic alignment or thinking about choosing China as the alternative to the West or to the United States. I don't think that's the issue. I never thought that was the fundamental issue, not the least because the Chinese are not available in that context. I think the impact is the extent to which an important part of the Russian political establishment is increasingly attracted to the Chinese model, political model. And you've seen over the last year a kind, if you will, reorientation toward China on that score, both in political organization with the political party, with the dominant political party that Putin and others rely on. I think it's sentiment in the Putin circles and around them, and that obviously has an impact on the degree to which one can in the future expect Russia to move in directions domestically that will be supportive of a Western option or of working with the United States. And that, I finish with, raises the further problem of Russia's domestic orientation. It is the favorite cocktail conversation when people talk about Russia to discuss the diarchy, Medvedev and Putin, what that's all about, who's up and who's down. Maybe some of that can occur during the question and answer period. Here, from my point of view, the more important significance is that at some level, that is both symbolic and the ultimate arena in which this struggle between a greater orientation toward the West or selecting the Asian option gets played out. I don't want to oversimplify. I'm not arguing that Putin is the Asian option and Medvedev is the Western option. But the more that diarchy or that power hierarchy tilts toward Medvedev, the less likely it is that this business of exploring the Chinese option will open up. And the more it tilts or returns entirely to the Putin side, the more that begins to open up. So there are a series of very significant factors that are constraints on how far and fast this relationship can move. But we ought to be thankful that it's moved as far as it has and that we've reversed what were very negative and unfortunate trends when this started January a year ago. Thank you.